Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In the last several weeks, the Trump administration's separation of some 3,000 immigrant children from their parents at the border has propelled cries of moral outrage and calls for family reunification. In the eyes of many, the policies represent a betrayal of American values. But if you examine the history of the Latino experience near the U.S.-Mexico border, you'll find even more horrific precursors of racially charged violence. That's what our guests today have been doing. Here to talk about border history and provide some context for what's happening today are journalist Michelle Garcia and Monica Munoz Martinez, professor of American and Ethnic Studies at Brown University. Michelle, Monica, I welcome you both to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So, Michelle, you recently published an article in The Baffler called "The Border and the American Imagination." You're making the argument that words such as zero tolerance and immigration crisis are proxies for discrimination against Mexicans that's been happening for generations. And you say that, quote, "the weeping children on the border are the latest casualties in a pattern of racial violence that began in the 19th century." Start us off there. Describe this period.
Sure. So you have in the 19th century in Texas, before the formation of the border as we know it now, you had incoming newcomers to the territory, whites from the southern states, slave-owning states, states where the Indian Removal Act had occurred, coming in, making contact with Tejanos, Mexicans living here, and they're deemed a mongrel race, racially inferior, abomination, because of the intermingling between European blood and native blood. And from that moment forward, Mexicans, Mexican Americans, were viewed by many as racially inferior. And from that came a policy, a history of violence, of subjugation, Jim Crow, and that became culturally entrenched, so much so that it almost goes unquestioned. And in many ways, largely, has contributed to the crisis that we see on the border, a crisis that is described as an immigration crisis, as if the presence of the immigrants provokes this violence. What I do in the piece is look at the violence that exists and persists, waiting for the next opportunity to express itself, as we have seen recently.
Monica, you are the founder of an organization called Refusing to Forget and the principal investigator of the Mapping Violence Online Project. You also have a forthcoming book about this history. Tell us about these efforts. What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, thanks. And I'm so happy to be with you today and also to be joining Michelle, who's just done incredible work in her journalism to share this longer history of violence and the creation of the border. I'm a historian of racial violence in the early 20th century, and I primarily study immigration and policing histories. But I also recognize that violence and injustice don't stay in the past. Unacknowledged injustice impacts entire communities for generations. And so my book examines a stark period of state terror on the U.S.-Mexico border 100 years ago. But I've been working with my colleagues in Refusing to Forget to commemorate this period of violence, because most people don't know that this happened. And so we're working to try to commemorate this period. But, you know, these efforts are happening in the midst of another humanitarian crisis on the border, which really compels our efforts to make these histories public, because America really has a problem with righting our wrongs because we choose to forget these histories of violence, or worse, we whitewash them in our understandings of the past. So this is some of what Michelle is speaking to, the fact that, you know, the history of Indian removal in 1830 and the American War of Aggression with Mexico that, you know, resulted in the United States requiring half of Mexico, that those are remembered in the United States as progress, right, as opposed to histories of colonization and histories of genocide and violence. And as a result, we still are learning how to interpret. You know, many people are looking to the past to figure out how we got to this point and to this crisis.
So what do you mean by commemorate, Monica? How are you trying to commemorate some of these points in history?
Well, we've worked actively with state cultural institutions. So our first major event was an exhibit at the Texas State History Museum here in Austin, the Bullock Museum. And the exhibit was called Life and Death on the Border from 1910 to 1920. And it documented this period, this decade of brutal violence in which hundreds, if not thousands, of ethnic Mexicans, some were Mexican nationals and many were American citizens, were targets of violence at the hands of the Texas Ranger, the state police force, U.S. soldiers, and Anglo vigilantes. And so this museum was the first time that the state of Texas was acknowledging this period of violence, but also acknowledging the role of Texas governors, of the Texas State Ranger Force, in calling for violence. But it also recovered an important history of resistance, the stories of people like Jovita Edad, Texas State Representative Jose Ticanales. You know, these were active citizens who protested the violence and asked for change. So, you know, working with state cultural institutions like the Bullock Museum, we're also working with the Texas Historical Commission to have historical marker unveilings in South Texas. So we unveiled one in Cameron County to commemorate the peak of violence in 1915. We'll also be having another unveiling in El Paso to commemorate the Porvenir Massacre, which was an act of brutality that occurred in 1918 and really raised public concern about the escalating violence.
Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Yeah, so, you know, the Porvenir Massacre is this really heartbreaking and gut-wrenching story of a ranching community in West Texas. In January 1918, a Company B of the Texas Rangers called on the U.S. cavalry that were local in the area to visit this ranching community in the middle of the night on January 28, 1918. They separated the men some young boys from the women and younger children and elderly men. And that night they massacred these unarmed men and boys. So in total, 15 were murdered that night. And what it led to was actually this long history of generations of these descendants of that massacre seeking justice for the events, the tragedies that occurred that night.
So, Michelle, when we talk about how Donald Trump ascended to the presidency, it's nearly always in the same breath as a discussion of anti-immigrant rhetoric. So his language describing immigrants is often construed in terms of criminality or something less than, quote unquote, you know, real Americans. What are some of the precursors, both overt and subtle, to this rhetoric?
Well, I've written a number of pieces saying that what Donald Trump has done in both rhetoric is and in policy has built on his predecessors. In the rhetoric about animals or immigrants or Latinos as infesting or in some way less than human, that was occurring in Texas with the man who's now lieutenant governor, ran on that, saying that immigrants bring third world diseases. So we have the media representation of immigrants as criminals. More than half of representations of Mexican Latino immigrants is that of criminals. We also have this over time through cultural representation, journalism, history, historical renditions, and then, of course, policy and political rhetoric has created in the public imagination an image of Latinos as Mexican Americans as the perennial foreigner, as dangerous, and never really American. So there's a number of players and actors that he has drawn from. And what I write is that he's not an aberration, he's the culmination.
And you can sort of see this in a very, you know, I know that on the streets of New York City, I often get asked where I'm from, and I'm sure that you guys probably get that question as well, which I don't really take offense to, but it does beg the question, are people assuming that I am not American and from here?
I think that from the beginning, the racial, the United States talks about race largely as black and white. So when you have Latinos and a history that's different from an East Coast history, one that's also very rooted in the frontier, that border and the frontier and immigration becomes the proxy for discussions of Latinos with a racialization. And so if we think about, for example, in New York, Irish as being part of the fabric and the identity of New York City, right? As almost, I mean, default American, right? But when it comes to Latinos, citizenship has always, from the beginning historically, been questioned about whether to extend citizenship to Mexicans who were living in the territory of Texas at the end of the U.S.-Mexico War, whether Mexicans, Mexican-Americans, were racially unfit. That was the argument, to actually become U.S. citizens. And so what we have and what we experience now is the where are you from, how long have you been here, because you could not have already been three or four generations. And as if the people who are asking the question are entitled to the mantle of Americans in a way that Latinos are not.
Listeners, what questions do you have for our guests about the historical precursors to the border crisis? What questions do you have about the experience of Mexican Americans in Texas? How have you arrived at your own reckoning with the history of racial violence in this country? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Monica, how has uncovering the history of racial violence towards Mexicans and Mexican Americans in the U.S. informed how you understand the current marginalization and segregation of Latinos within modern American society?
Well, Cindy, there are striking parallels, unfortunately. You know, what Michelle was gesturing to in thinking about the political rhetoric that is resurging, you know, this sort of anti-immigrant sentiment that has become a political talking point for some campaigns, you know, really gained momentum in the 1990s and has continued until today. And so that's one thing that, you know, today we're talking about cartel members and gangsters. And 100 years ago, you know, any Mexican was assumed to be a bandit or a revolutionary. And so that kind of criminalizing people leads to violence. And when the public buys into that sentiment, it also creates a culture of impunity so that, you know, the policing, the violent policing, the murder or the detentions of people for the most part, go unanswered by humanitarian calls. And so, you know, for decades, centers like Colibri, the Center for Human Rights, has been calling attention to the thousands of people that are dying trying to cross into the border and into the country. And, you know, that is because of deterrence policy that was implemented into the 1990s. But it finally took children, you know, crying in cages to raise public awareness. And so, you know, part of what the history teaches us is that we have to look at the systemic patterns that create these conditions, and we have to avoid falling into these traps by politicians that criminalize people, that call them, that make us fearful of immigrants and refugees, and that results in the denial of due process, a culture of impunity for excessive force and abuse by detention centers or by officers, but that also that we have to turn to this longer history of agents that have made social change. And so some of the hard work and the harrowing work that I hear from, you know, immigration attorneys, advocates, is there's a long history of Americans who have fought for social justice. And that is a part of our legacy that Americans are really tapping into right now to demand change.
Cindy, so, if I can just add one thing to that, which is, you know, I've been covering, and from the beginning of my career, immigration in some form, beginning with the effects of 1996 immigration reform under Bill Clinton. And it has been cyclical, where there would be new legislation, an outcry, some coverage. In 96, it was laws targeting green card holders and making crimes, petty crimes that they had committed, years, decades prior, suddenly deportable crimes. And I would track these stories over and over again. And what I came to realize is why, and I began to question and change the direction of my work, is why does the border and this image can possess so much political currency, social currency in our country that is unlike other people, unlike other immigrants, so much so that it doesn't matter whether immigration, illegal border crossings is up or down. People are calling for border security. After 9/11, you had the creation of the border wall. So what I feel like we're talking about is the perception and the policy of this country that insists on a violent expression on the frontier.
Michelle, let's take a call from Michaela in Trenton, New Jersey. Michaela, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Go
can
ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear
sorry.
You. That's all right.
Yeah, I guess my comment, so I live in Trenton right now, but I was raised in Houston, just southeast in a suburb. And in Texas public school, we take 2 years of Texas history. And it wasn't really until this call when I was listening in during my lunch break that I heard of any of the events that you and your guests have been describing. And like I myself personally have been to the border. We went every Thanksgiving with our church. And my mom, she is of Mexican descent, but she was adopted. And even in her own adoption, we never really thought that much of it. We always thought like, to us, like in Texas, we think of it as like a very like welcoming place, at least in my area, because like in anyone's family, you can kind of like find someone who is of Hispanic descent. But it wasn't really until listening to the story and also listening to Latino USA that I've heard of these kind of horrific events that occurred in a place that I called home for until I went to college and moved up to the East Coast.
Michaela, thank you so much for that comment. Michelle, Monica, why don't we know more of this history?
That's a great question, and it's one that I explore at length in my book. And, you know, one part of it comes back into the way that history is crafted and remembered. You know, there is a hero myth of the Texas Rangers that looms large in Texas. And so, you know, for most Texans, they say they're unsettled when they hear this history. And, you know, this decade was an atrocious period of violence. But the roots of the Texas Rangers, you know, were violent as well. They participated in Native genocide. They participated in capturing, you know, people who were trying to escape slavery, who were traveling through Texas to reach Mexico. And, you know, in the 19-teens, the violence was only expanded in part because of the militarization of the border. You also had U.S. soldiers who were training for World War I, and so they were using new military technologies on the border. And it's also important to note here that it's not just immigrants or Mexican refugees that were coming into the United States fleeing the Mexican Revolution, but it was also American citizens that were targeted by this violence. And so somebody's American citizenship or their class or their status didn't protect them from violence. And so, but we don't remember this history because Texas and Texas cultural institutions and popular culture have actively told a history that erases this or disavows the violence of this and instead calls it justice. They call this a moment of Anglo superiority in being able to secure the border. And so this really does feed into these myths that we have that are troubling to confront. But, you know, when we have had these events in Texas, the museum exhibit opening in the Bullock or these commemorations for the Texas State Historical Markers, hundreds of people attend. You know, over 40,000 people came to the Bullock Museum.
Wow.
And so Texans are ready to have this conversation. And for most people who do know this history, their family histories have been disavowed for over a century. And that's too long for somebody to have to wait for a public acknowledgement of a crime against humanity that they have lived with.
Monica, Michelle, let's take a quick break. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Cindy Rodriguez filling in for Brian. We're going to take a break and then we'll be back with journalist Michelle Garcia and Brown University professor Monica Munoz Martinez. Plus your calls. Stay with us. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, filling in for Brian. We're speaking with journalist Michelle Garcia and Brown University professor Monica Munoz-Martinez. Michelle, I want to go back to you for a second. Your article is writing about the Texas-Mexico border. We are in New York City. This is a local New York City show. But there is also an inclusion of a New Yorker in your article, Walt Whitman. Can you tell me about this quote and where it came from?
Absolutely. I think there's this sense that New York is so far from the border and these perceptions and this lost history that we've been talking about, when in fact New York has played a very significant role, the whole East Coast has. When we look at the run-up to the U.S.-Mexico War, we had Walt Whitman publishing in the Brooklyn Eagle, calling Mexico burlesque, superstitious. I mean, his disdain for Mexico was well known. In fact, one of my ancestors wrote a book criticizing Walt Whitman and critiquing his work as being imperialistic, racist, and anti-Mexican. We also had in New York a fierce debate going on about what to do on the quote-unquote frontier, with Horace Greeley arguing that this notion of aggressive Mexico plunging the United States into war was a falsehood that has no life and no validity to it, and that this was really an attempt to expand slavery. But we all know that what Greeley called a falsehood became national mythology and shaped the perception of the border. And it's important to remember, too, that our understanding of citizenship, the frontier, Mexicans, Latinos, was being crafted as well by publishing, which, as we know, is centered in New York. And so beginning in the early days, you have military dispatches being published in New York magazines about their efforts to quell the frontier. And this is all shaping. It's forming a template and a paradigm through which we as journalists, it shapes and informs the way we as journalists report on and perceive violence and what goes on the border. And in that same piece, I'm the former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review, a Newsweek article that was out a few years ago called Hunting Humans, in which it was reported that ranchers in South Texas were laying traps, were chasing down migrants, were hunting them, referring to them as dogs. In what other place in this country, and with who, what other people, would that be acceptable and not provoke outrage? But somehow violence is expected almost on the U.S.-Mexico border and on the frontier, and this comes as a result of a constructed narrative. And when we ask, why don't we know about this history, the lynching and so forth that Monica was referring to, many of those investigations were locked up for 60 years in the archives, unstudied, until someone went and pulled them out. We have recently in Texas, finally, after a long struggle on behalf of activists, a ethnic studies, and even then that was contentious because the Board of Education wanted to call it Ethnic Studies, an Overview of Americans of Mexican Descent, rather than Mexican-Americans. So even now, labels, definitions, and narratives form a very important part in perception and therefore policy.
So education can be highly politicized in Texas. We have a call from Evan in Brooklyn. Evan, are you there? Evan, are you still there? Sorry to keep you waiting. What's your comment?
So I wanted to make a comment. I grew up in Texas, and I'm descended from, on my dad's side, from Latinos who've lived there since Texas was a Spanish colony. And, this has been a big part of my family's experience. My dad, grew up in El Paso, and like my grandma used to, go grocery shopping in Mexico. And, he definitely felt like he had to leave El Paso because he was being discriminated against. And, but at the same time, I didn't really grow up, I'm white passing for sure, and I didn't really grow up thinking of myself as Mexican. I didn't even really see a difference between Latinos and white people growing up. I didn't see that, but I did know that there was a difference between us and Mexicans. Mexicans were definitely those other people across the border. That they were the ones that didn't know how to speak English or whatever, and I see that in my family today. Now seeing the way people are talking about. Or with what's going on now, I see people in my own family who definitely, want to say, those are not us, we are not Mexicans, and they take a very strong line against immigrants. And I've seen, headlines about Latinos in Texas who, who are anti-immigrant or Trump supporters, and I guess that's, as if it were a surprising thing, and to me, it's part of the fabric, I guess, of that experience of, both experiencing. He has the discrimination and also the kind of confusion about race and citizenship. And
Evan, thank you so much for that comment. That's really interesting. Monica, we have about a minute left. How do you respond to this idea of racism between Latinos themselves?
That's a long history. We have a long history of that. But he's also speaking to this larger assumption that Americans have that people who are trying to come into the United States today aren't doing it the right way. And historians of immigration have actually shown that immigration restrictions create these patterns of undocumented migration. And historically, U.S. legislators have had to pass, have given amnesty to European immigrants and to Mexican immigrants in the past. And so there's this sense that, amnesty now is a bad word. And amnesty is a part of our American history that has corrected these misguided immigration policies in the past.
Ladies, we have to leave it there. That's all the time we have. Monica Munoz Martinez is a professor of American and Ethnic Studies at Brown University. She's the founder of the organization Refusing to Forget and the author of the forthcoming book, The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Michelle Garcia is a journalist. She recently published the first in a series of three articles on the border for the Baffler magazine. Thanks to you both for joining us. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, Urban Affairs reporter at WNYC, filling in for Brian Lehrer.